All right. Well, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Rhonda Layfield. And you have to excuse me, I'm allergic to something here. Last year I wasn't allergic to anything, but my voice is like coming and going a little bit now. So I think I'll make it through the talk. I think it'll be okay. I already mentioned that I've been in IT for 30 years. I joined the Navy in 1982, and I spent 7 years in the U.S. Navy. And to join the Navy, you take this test, find out what you'd be good at. And they said, oh, you'd be good with computers. Well, I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's right in the middle of the United States, and it is the most boring place on the planet. So I said, okay, do I get to leave Tulsa? They're like, yes. I'm like, I'll do anything. I'll paint boats. I'll do anything you ask. So that's how I got started in IT, and I've loved it ever since. I've been an IT pro all those years, worked with hardware, software, deployments I've been specializing in about the last 4 years. And I live in Washington, D.C. now. And most of my clients, just to kind of give you an idea as to what I do every day, most of my clients are between 50,000 and 150,000 machines to roll out deployments to. So they're usually pretty large environments. I've done a lot of work for Customs and Border Protection up there, NCUA. I'm starting to talk to Interpol, which could be interesting, because then I could travel the whole world doing their deployments. So hoping that works out. And I mention this, I am so surprised there's this many people in the room for this talk, profiles, user profiles. I want to tell you why I decided to do this talk. Everywhere I go and do the deployment sessions, people come up and ask me, what about user profiles? You know they're broken in Windows 7, right? Yeah, did you guys know that? Who's tried to edit your default user profile in Windows 7? Let's see it. Who succeeded? Two, three. Oh, Johan, he can make anything work. It's not as easy as it used to be. Now, I'm going to show you the Microsoft recommended way to do this, but since I'm not Microsoft, I'm going to show you the way I've broken down and had to do this for a few clients, just so if you have to back up and do this, you can still get the job done for your clients. So we're going to start out with local profiles, talk a little bit about roaming, and then mandatory profiles. You set these up completely different. And who's ever heard of a super mandatory profile? Again, two people. Awesome. That'll be one new piece of information. And as I go through each one of these, I'm going to show you what you need to do to set up a mandatory profile, what you need to do to set up a super mandatory profile as well. And you will know the difference between the two. Then we're going to talk a little bit about folder redirection with Windows 7, get into their documented, approved way of editing the default user profile, which doesn't work. And then I'll show you how I do it. And I'm not going to look at that side of the room. There's some deployment gurus over there, and they're going to yell and scream when I show you this, so I'm going to completely ignore them at that point. The last topic I want to hit on is migrating those XP profiles to Windows 7 using the user state migration tool. You shouldn't have to figure this out on your own. There are tools out there that can help you get through this. Everybody's familiar with your local profiles. You log on to a machine, and you get the default user profile written over into your user account. As you log off the machine, any changes that you make will be saved into your profile. That's local to that one machine. Has anyone ever set up a default network profile? Anybody at all? About six, maybe seven. So if you want to set up a profile that everybody's going to use, you can set it up in the net logon share on your domain controller. That's the first place your domain clients look for a profile. So when a user sits down at a domain joined machine, it will look in the net logon share, which is actually, let's see, on your DC, it's going to be in the sysvol scripts folder. And you'll put the profile there, and users will always get that profile. Now, that's just going to be the first default profile they get. They can make changes to it, and then it will always be a local profile for them. So it's just that first time they log on, this is where they'll get their profile from. The steps for creating your network user profile is you're going to log on to a Windows 7 machine with a user account that is not a domain administrator. Make all your profile change settings, desktop, themes, anything you'd like to change. Log off, log back on that same machine as a domain admin this time, and then you're going to copy that profile to the net logon share, and you're going to name it defaultuser.v2. So up to this point, we've been using user profiles version 1. How many years have we been using version 1? Probably about 20. So this is the first time we have version 2. So it came out with Vista. Vista and Windows 7 profiles are very, very different animals than what we were used to with the old XP environments. Then, on that Windows 7 machine, you're logged on as the domain admin. You're going to go to the properties of the computer, go to the Profiles tab, and then you'll have a list of all the profiles that are there. The profile of the user you logged on as that was not a domain admin, you'll highlight that and then just click Copy To, put it in the net logon share on your domain controller. So that's how you get that first network profile out there. If you guys have any questions, feel free to stop me right then and there. I don't need to wait until the end. I always hate that. I always forget my questions by the end of the talk. Roaming profiles. I'm sure you guys are familiar with what roaming profiles are. They're stored on a central server. When the user logs on, they connect across the network and download their profile from there. With Windows 7, if a roaming profile is not accessible when the user logs on, a temporary profile gets created locally on that machine. When the user logs off, that profile is deleted. So it cleans up after itself. The next type is a mandatory profile. This can be either local or it could be a roaming profile stored on that central server. When the users get the mandatory profile, they can make changes during that one session. But when they log off, their changes are not saved. So when they log back on again, everything should be set back to the mandatory profile settings that you had originally created. Nothing's changed there. It's the same as the old mandatory profiles. What has changed is how you create it. In the old days, all you had to do was change that ntuser.dat to be ntuser. I just saw about 12 people go, man. Change dat to man, M-A-N. And that made it a mandatory profile. It's not going to work anymore. That does nothing for your profiles in Windows 7. What you want to do is, if you're creating a mandatory profile for a specific user, then you would, let's just say it's on the server, central roaming profiles, you would create a folder, share a folder. I like to just name it profiles, keep it nice and simple. And then create a folder for each user. The folder name has to be the username, and if you want it to be mandatory, username.mandatory.v2. That's what's going to make that a mandatory roaming profile. If you want to do it for a whole bunch of users to use the same mandatory profile, then you're just going to name it mandatory.v2. And then in Active Directory, you can point all your user accounts to use that specific profile you've created. All right, the new one, super mandatory profiles. This is really just an additional layer of security. I'm not sure how many people are going to go this far. On a mandatory profile, if you can't access the server, you can still get logged onto that machine. With a super mandatory profile, if you can't connect to the server where your profile resides, you don't get logged onto that machine. Does this sound like something anybody's going to do? I'm curious, honestly. Maybe about 4 people. So you must have some type of heavy, secure environment that you would want to set this up. If the user can't get to that mandatory profile, they don't get logged onto that machine. All right, so to create the super mandatory profile, you'll create a mandatory profile, like we previously did, and then you're going to rename it from that mandatory.v2 to just man.v2. So for Susie, her user account, if I just want Susie's profile to be a super mandatory, the folder I would create for her would be susie.man.v2. And then I have to go into Active Directory Users and Computers, open Susie's user account, go to the Profile tab. On the Profile path, I would input the name of my server. This is my UNCPath, Universal Naming Convention. The name of my server is MDT2012, and then the name of the folder that I've shared is Profiles, And within that, we'll find a folder named Suzy.man. That's the path you point to. So you don't put the V2 in the Active Directory user properties. Strange, isn't it? All right, let's jump over and talk a little bit about folder redirection. There's all kinds of fun new group policy settings we have for folder redirection in Windows 7. And this is just kind of a high-level view. I'm going to take you into each one of these and talk about which ones are enabled, which ones are disabled by default, and what they can do for you. So we'll hit folder redirection. You guys remember in XP when we set up folder redirection? Your users had to log on twice. The first time they logged on, they just found out that they were going to do folder redirection. The second time they logged on, they actually started doing folder redirection. With Windows 7, it's just one log on. You don't have to log on twice for it to take effect. And it also requires offline files. So to talk about offline files, these are the group policy settings that I'm going to take you through. We'll talk about what's enabled by default, what a fast first log on is. We'll take a look at usually offline support with background sync, an exclusion list you can create now, and transparent caching. That first topic was the fast first log on, and mainly it has to do with the first time you log on. When you're doing folder redirection in XP, it was copying all those files down locally for you. And users that had a lot of data up there, it could take a long time for them to get logged on because the desktop wasn't presented to them until all their files were copied down locally. With Windows 7, it just takes a snapshot of the files that reside there. So it's not actually performing the entire copy. So you get logged on a lot faster. Usually offline support with background sync. This allows you to have your files being saved on the server while the user is logged on. Once again, with the old version, the user's files, they get copied down to the local machine, and then the user makes changes to them, and when they log off is the only time that those files are stored back up on the server if there were any changes to them. Yes? I'm talking about offline files. That's the way offline files work, is that you get a snapshot of you're redirecting the files, but for offline, it actually caches the information locally just in case you go offline. You take those machines home, you don't have access to the server anymore, you still have access to your data in that offline cache. So you're right, folder redirection is saying redirect my documents up to that folder, but offline cache is what allows you to still, yeah, take the machine away with you. I can't hear you. Gosh, what was the question? He mentioned folder redirection isn't copying files down. And I said, yes, that's absolutely right. Folder redirection is saying when I click my documents, you go to the server and get it for me. It's offline files cache that actually brings it local. And those two are working hand in hand now. So what usually offline support with background sync, and that is the name of the group policy object you're going to be setting up if you decide to go this route, allows your offline files to be synced while the user's logged on. And you can tell it how often you want it to sync the files up. So it doesn't have to wait until you log off and then try to push everything back up to the server again. You can also set up how fast a connection, a good way to put this. With offline files, your machine can go offline for more than one reason. It's not just because you took the machine home. What happens if all of a sudden your bandwidth to the server that you're connecting to, I don't know, a default gateway goes down. You're in a branch office. Maybe your WAN link goes down. You can't get to it anymore. So there are different reasons why a machine might think that it's offline. It's not just because you took it home. So it should intermittently check to see if it's in a slow connection state. And I always wonder, well, what is a slow connection state? The default slow connection state is a data transfer rate of 64,000 bytes per minute, or less. And this is configurable through a group policy. You can go in and tell it, no, that's not slow. You can make it slower, you can make it faster, you can choose to do anything you want. You can set up an exclusion list for files that you don't want to be presented into offline caching, possibly users' MP3 files, or just a lot of data that you don't think they need and you don't want to bog down the network with. So you can create an exclusion list based on the extension of the file types. Transparent caching. The first time a file's opened from a shared folder, it's going to be cached locally. And then upon opening the file again, it's always going to want to open the local file, but it kind of phones home to the server, and it asks the server for the date and timestamp of last modification on that file. If it sees that the local file is a newer version or the same version, it will open it locally, so it doesn't waste network bandwidth to go get it and open it again. If the server's not available for you to check on the modification, date and timestamps, then you're not able to open that file because it can't guarantee that you're opening the latest version of it. Transparent caching is disabled by default, but you can once again enable it using group policies. This is where you put or where all your policies exist, and there are 28 new policies that you can go in and play around with and configure for your offline caching. If it thinks that the local file is newer, will it automatically save it back to the network? Yes, at the defined thresholds that you have set. But if you opened it before it got copied back up to the server, so the one local is newer, then it would go ahead and open that one. And then the next time it's supposed to check in, based on your configuration of the group policy, it will copy it back up to the server. That's that background sync. And you can go in and tell it how often you want it to copy saved files back up to the server. Can you see the offline files locally?
The main reason I'm asking is, like, let's say there's some data that they copied from the network and trying to get the data to another PC outside the line. So, like, can they actually get the offline files from the PC and transfer it to another computer?
So you want to take the offline files out of the cache from one machine and put it into another machine?
That's right.
Yeah, it's in the cache, and you can see the cache through the sync center. It actually shows you all the files that are in there. And you could always open it, do a file save as, put it on a USB stick, and go take it someplace else. I mean, so sure, there's going to be lots of ways to do that. And that's a perfect question for that time, because the last bullet here is the Sync Center, and that is the first demo. If you guys haven't seen the Sync Center before on a Windows 7 machine, just type sync, it'll pop up for you. There's your Sync Center. If you had any conflicts of files that you couldn't access, and there can be conflicts with date and timestamps getting out of sync, so if you have a conflict and it doesn't know which one's actually the newer or the latest and greatest file, you could see conflicts in here. And any conflicts that you had would be listed. And then you can right-click and choose what you want to do with that. You can mark which one is the latest and greatest and take care of the conflict manually. You can view the sync results to make sure everything's working properly or to know when you have a problem. You can set up new sync partners. And you can also manage your offline files. So this is where we could disable. Offline files are enabled by default. We're already in the Sync Center. This is where if you had offline files, you would be able to see them. So opening the Sync Center and going to view your offline files, you'd get a list of everything that's in the cache there. You can find out how much of your hard drive space is being used by the cached information, and you can change how much is allowed to be used. Most people set this in a group policy. You don't want to run around to every single machine and do this, so these settings are available in a group policy as well. You can choose to encrypt your files. By default, they're not encrypted, but if it's sensitive data, you might want to go ahead and encrypt those files. And the last setting we have here is on slow connections. How often should it actually check to see if that machine is in a slow connection state? So the default is set to check every 5 minutes. You can change that to be whatever you choose. And then what it determines to be the slow connection state is what you would also set in a group policy. That's your sync center. All right, now we'll get into some of the fun stuff. Customizing the default user profile. So you're going to log on as a local administrator. Make sure there are no other users that have logged on to that machine. I love the documentation sometimes. I giggle when I read it. It's like you could have undesired results because you don't know which one it's going to pick. If you had multiple profiles that are on that machine, it can randomly pick one of the other profiles. And it actually says that in the documentation. You're like, wow, that doesn't sound very stable. So make sure there's only one profile that's set up on that machine. And then you'll make your profile changes, and then you're going to sysprep that machine with an answer file. Has anyone done this yet? How many out of those 20 people were happy with the results? About 6. You had to do it a few times? He says, the only problem I've ever had is every time I do it, the background image goes out the window. And BG Info fixes it for him. Yeah, the last bullet point on here, when you do walk through all these, some things just don't stick. And they won't document what sticks and what doesn't. So you're saying you boot into audit mode first to do these steps and to sysprep it from being in audit mode. The sysprep command that you guys are going to use is in system Windows folder, System 32. I like just the graphical one. You can just put check marks in the box. I still don't understand the default. Who wants to sysprep the machine and restart it immediately? Don't you want to shut it down? Because I've had people sysprep the machine. They accept the default of restart when it's done sysprepping. So it syspreps, shuts down, boots back up. Now you have to go through sysprep mini setup wizard. And I think you can only sysprep like 5 times. That was really confusing when the products first came out because some of the bits, if you download it from MSDN, you can only sysprep 3 times. Some of them from TechNet, you can only do 5. Some of them, it didn't matter. It was so confusing. So I think they've standardized now on like sysprepping a machine 5 times and that's it. If you're going to do it from a command line, you would do sysprep with the UBI switch. Out-of-box experience, tell it to shut down, not restart, generalize, and then you're going to give it a Windows System Image Manager script, WSIM script. And the one thing you're going to have turned on in that script is the copy to profile will be set to true. Has anyone created a WSIM script? I love that one. Only one person was this, everybody else is like, oh. If you sat my talk earlier, I showed you what a WSIM script looks like. This is not the easiest tool to use. In fact, the first time I opened it, I looked at it, I'm like, I don't even know where to get started. I shut it down, I'm like, I'm never going to use that. And then I spent the next 3 months figuring out how to use that tool because I figured if I'm going to be a deployment person, I really need to know how to do that. So the WSIM scripts, it's not an intuitive tool to use. A couple problems you can run into with WSIM scripts are sometimes when you add components to your answer file, you can add it in more than one place. And the documentation is not really very helpful about, well, what happens if I put it here versus here or here or here? And it lists all 7 configuration passes for you, which a configuration pass is just a stage of the installation. That's all it is. It's just a fancy name. Instead of calling it the 7 stages of an installation, they're called configuration passes. And so if you do put a component into one of the configuration passes, sometimes based on which pass you put it into, it can cause the installation to do an additional reboot. So sometimes you go in and add a whole bunch of settings, and you sit down, you do a normal installation. Well, normally it should reboot like 3 times. And you sit there and watch the machine reboot 7 times. You're like, well, that added 20 minutes to my deployment. So what you'd have to do then is go look at those components, find out what other configuration passes you can put them in, and start moving things around. Because sometimes when you move it from one pass to another, it gets rid of that additional reboot. And the documentation's not going to be your friend there. You're just going to have to test it on your own. The biggest problem that I found with this is not everything gets copied. And like I mentioned, Microsoft, well, they told me they're not going to document what does get copied and what doesn't get copied. Has anybody ever seen a list of what gets scrubbed in a sysprep? It's because it doesn't exist. I don't believe them.
If you knew what it was scrubbing, you'd know what you could change yourself to reset your timeouts and the timeout.
NT Workstation. Anybody roll out NT Workstations? What, probably like version 4.0? There were a couple brothers over in India who reverse engineered sysprep. And so back then, we did have a list of everything that was scrubbed from sysprep, but I haven't seen anybody do that yet with Windows 7. I think it'd be nice to know what gets scrubbed, what doesn't. All right, this is where I'm going to deviate. And I'm ignoring that side of the room now, because I know they're going to say, don't do it like that. Now, first of all, when I do my deployments, if my clients don't have System Center Configuration Manager, I'm using the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit. So that's what I'm going to show you here. And this is modifying the default user profile. So I have this little teeny tiny CMD file that I've created. Can you guys see that? Is that big enough text? Who's tried to figure out how to edit your default power configuration settings? He actually has pretty much a grimace. How'd it work for you? Pretty easy? There's actually a bug that if you go in and you change your power configuration settings, it doesn't show up in the displayed settings. It's actually a bug out there. It's documented. So I figured out a way to do it, and this took me 3 days. I'll admit it. It took me 3 days to figure this guy out. So what I did is I used the PowerCFG command line utility. And the first thing I did is took the default that it was set to, took the GUID. Now, nobody likes to type these GUIDs out, right? So if you do a list, do a PowerCFG, G, tell it to list all the power configuration settings for you, and then just pipe it to a text file, and now you can just come in and copy and paste all this, so you don't have to sit there and type those GUIDs out. That is not a fun day. So you find out what the GUID is, because everything you're doing here has to be based on the GUID as the name. So this is where I'm getting the GUIDs that I'm using for my little tiny script here. And I take the first one that it's already set to, and I change it so that that is no longer the selected. So I have to choose a different GUID to be the selected GUID, because I'm going to use one of the existing GUIDs. So I have to take it from the default it's set to, set it to something other than the default. I just picked any of them. And then I deleted the one that was the default. That's what the D is. Then I copied over my power settings that are stored in a .pow file, imported my power settings into this GUID, which is a recognized GUID, and then I set it to run that power setting for the GUID. That's the only way I could get this guy to work and be the same on every single machine that rolled out. So now when you go in and look at the power configuration settings in the display, it says what's really set. Here's some default user customizations. Now let me show you this real quick. Pop back over into MDT. And what I'm looking at here is a deployment share. Now a deployment share is really just a glorified shared folder. That's all it is. This is the folder that your clients will connect to across the network in order to perform their deployments. So let's open that actual folder. This is what that folder looks like. So when they connect, this is the top level folder that they're connecting to. What I have in MDT is I've added that install.cmd as an application to run. So after the OS is deployed, I tell it to go ahead and run this guy. It's just install.cmd. And notice the working directory. This is a really important point. The working directory starts with a dot. That dot represents this folder structure. So if it represents the deployment share root, then it's looking at, for this application to be installed, I'm going to go into the Applications folder, and then I'm going to go into the Profiles folder. I told it where this was, and I'm going to run install.cmd. So if we come back here to the Applications folder, Profiles folder, here's my install.cmd. But notice there are some other things in that folder as well. Got a couple of reg keys in there, BG info, and a folder that has a corporate theme set up for it for my desktop users. So if we go back to the install.cmd, what we are adding is I have some special icons, registry settings for icons that I want to add. Notice I'm copying iconscu.reg and iconsdu.reg. Those are in that same folder. So I don't have to specify some great big path to them. Everything I do with this install.cmd is being run from the Applications Profiles folder, so I can just point directly to it. What I've seen a lot of people do is they'll map a drive, and then they'll use complete paths to everything, not knowing your Z drive's already mapped there. That's what MDT does for you. And that's one of the cool things about MDT. It takes away a lot of the hard work. It just does stuff for you, and it just works under the hood. So you've already got a Z drive mapped back to that dot to your deployment share. So notice I don't have to give it a complete path. Yes? Use which? Can you use pushd and popd? Why would you want to? You've already got a drive map that's already done. So I wouldn't use anything else. But I see people all the time in the front of their scripts mapping drives, and I'm like, why are you mapping drives? You've already got Z, it's already there, don't do it again. All right, so there's my icons, registry keys that I can add. For that theme that I want to add, I can just do an X copy. Everything from the theme folder down to the user profile, app data, local, Microsoft Windows themes, and then set that as my theme. And this is a working script. Everything in here works just fine. I know Johan's over there saying you should be doing it in VB. I don't know VB, and I don't want to go learn it. I want to just use the stuff I've already got and move on. Usually with deployments, you've got a list a mile long of everything they want to have done. So I just kind of use the stuff I already have upstairs here and try to make that work. Another troubleshooting tip, one reason I love to do it like this, is a lot of times I'll have like a cleanup script that runs, and it'll go out there and do like 75 things. Well, what happens if that script doesn't run properly? How do you know which of those 75 things didn't work? with this, I can pop in here. And put pause statements after everything. Or if it's a really big script, like the one that does 75 things, I might want to go a quarter of the way through the script and hit pause. And then another halfway, put in a pause. So what will happen is my script will run on the client machine after the installation of the operating system, and then it will run up until it hits that first pause, and then the command prompt will sit there with the pause telling you you need to press any key to continue. So then you could check and say, okay, it's not broken at this point, so I know everything in the first quarter of that script ran properly. Hit any key, and then it'll go to the second pause. Absolutely. Wouldn't it be easier just to write your answers out to a log file? And a lot of times when I run these, I will pipe the output to a log file just to go in and take a peek and see what's going on. But sometimes you don't know what happened. You just see that it aborted at a certain point. So you go in and start playing around with it, and that's where you might put a pause in between two or three statements to see exactly which statement, what's the problem in the script. But absolutely, there's often I'll just pipe it to a text file, and then I can open that log and look at it and see what worked, what didn't. I don't do that. What I'll do is come into MDT, and for the entire install.cmd, I pipe the whole thing out to a text file. And that way, every single command that runs in there records whether it succeeded or failed in the text file. So you could do either one. You could do individually, but I like to get just one great big, especially when you first start troubleshooting to find out where your problem is. Just get one big log file, go through it with a fine-tooth comb, then you can start kind of determining where your problem is. But you can set anything in user profiles by using these steps as well. All right. Let's get to migrating profiles from XP to Windows 7. Does anybody have questions up to this point? So the power config GUIDs, are they consistent across every? Oh, absolutely, yes. They're the same on every machine. Now, I haven't looked at SKUs to see if, I don't know, if Enterprise and Pro are the same. I haven't looked at that. But usually when I'm deploying, it's all enterprise clients anyway, and the GUIDs are the same on every single machine for power configuration. All right, what we have here is I have an XP SP2 machine, and I have a deployment server. The first thing you're going to want to do on those XP machines is upgrade your applications. Make sure your applications are where they're supposed to be for the version of the application you're going to want to install later on. This will make more sense in just a second. Then, you're going to run scan state on the XP machine, and I'll show you some example command lines of this, and store the user's data and settings and application settings over on that server. I do that because in between operating systems, I like to wipe the drive clean. At the last MVP summit, they teased me about it the entire week. Oh, yeah, you just like to wipe the drives clean. It's the only time you get to do it, and you don't end up with intermittent problems. So I always like to wipe it clean so I can't store my data and settings there. Then you're going to install Windows 7 on that machine. Install your applications again. You'll set this up in the MDT deployment workbench. And then you'll run load state, which will put the user's data, settings, and application settings back on that machine. Can't you wipe the drive clean if you use hard links? No. No. Hard links, it practically cements the information on the drive where it is. So what happens is, and we talk, I've got one slide in here on hard links for you guys who aren't familiar with it. Hard links, that's my problem with it, is you can't wipe that drive clean. It creates a little map of like where everything is, and then files can be laid down around it. I want the drive formatted. I want everything wiped clean, and that's my problem with hard links, but thank you. We had this conversation at the MVP summit. Wow. You know, and that's a great point. He says that one of his last clients, he had data, like 7 gigs of data. And so if you're copying that over to the server from the XP machine and then you're bringing it back down, that's like the only time I would ever use hard links is if I have somebody who might be using CAD or something that has just tons of data. You're looking at 20, 30 gigs of data. You don't want to copy it. That's the only time I would use hard links. But other than that, I like to format the drive, clean everything off, and then start from scratch. I've just seen over the years that there are less intermittent issues that you live with the whole version of that next operating system if you don't wipe the drive clean. All right, so how USMT works. It's not pretty. It's all command line. But it does work, and it works well. One of the things that I also like about MDT, it does USMT under the hood for you. And the command that it runs is the size of a paragraph. It's gigantic. But you didn't have to sit there and type the whole thing in. It does it for you. And during the deployment wizard on your client machines, all you have to do is put a check mark in a box that says save my user state. And then if you do want to use hard links, it's another check mark in a box. Done. If you want to put it on a server, it's a different selection. And then you can input the server name, shared folder where you'd like to store it. And then, on that folder, it actually creates another folder with the computer name and puts all the user state in there so you know which folder belongs to which computer. The operating systems that are supported for scan state and load state. The scan state utility is what scans that machine and gathers all the user's data, settings, and application settings. And Microsoft's not going to make it easy for you to load state back to an XP machine. So this is specifically USMT version 4.0. So scan state will run on XP Pro. It also runs on Vista, Windows 7. Load state will run on Vista and Windows 7, but not on XP. And also it doesn't run on any of your servers. If you try to do scan state on a server, it comes up and tells you it's an incorrect OS. Now, what is and what is not supported for USMT, you can migrate a 32-bit operating system to a 64, but you can't go the opposite direction. So you can't migrate 64 back to 32. And you can migrate from XP SP2 or 3. So going forward, if your XP machines are at least at XP Service Pack 2, then you're okay with all the tools. If you want to still continue to deploy XP is an operating system out to your client machines, XP SP3 is the supported OS. Requirements. You want to make sure when you run these, scan state and load state, that you log on as a local administrator. If you log on with just a normal non-admin account, you only get that one profile, your profile that you're logged in as. If there are multiple profiles on a machine, log in as a local admin and you get all the profile information. They've got some built-in scripts for user, application, and documents that are scanned for. You can gather information. Folders that will be migrated, my documents, my video, music, pictures, desktop files, start menu settings, quick launch settings, and favorites. But there's a lot more. So the old all users profile is now called the public profile on Windows 7. And these are the types of files that it's going to look for migration based on file extensions. And that's not all. There's a ton more. And it doesn't only look in those specific folders. It will actually go out and look on the entire hard drive. Have you ever had a user who accidentally stored something in the root of C and they can't find it? You have to go out to their desk? I love it when it's an hour and a half ride to get out there and all they did was put it at the root of C and you have to go out to their desk and help them find it and open it. Here's your document. So in this scenario, it would go through and scan the entire hard drive for any files with these extensions, and that would be part of your user's state. Settings that are migrated. Accessibility settings, address book, command prompt settings. Anything that has an asterisk on it is a setting that's not available for offline migration. So offline migration would be one you'd be starting from a WinPE environment. The operating system is not actually up and running. Encrypted files, i.e. favorites, folder options, fonts that you might have installed. I'm not going to go through every single one of these, but I did want you guys to have just in one place everything that USMT will gather information for. This is the last of the migrated settings it's going to gather information for. Application settings that are migrated. I'm not going to go through every single application, but I did want you to have it in one location. So these are the applications that are supported. Those settings will be stored in the user state as well, along with these applications. And I went ahead and put the version numbers in there also. What's that? 2010, huh? Yeah. Because, see, Microsoft Office is special. It's very special. With most applications, you can't take the application settings from an older version of an application and apply those to a Windows 7 machine that has a newer version of the application. Some applications you can. Did they put things in the same place? Are they in the same registry keys? If it's not from one version to another, then you're going to run into problems with those applications. That's why what you want to do is try to upgrade your applications to make sure you get the correct settings for the new version of the application you're going to put on Windows 7. But Office is a special animal, so you can migrate from one earlier version, like Office 2007, into 2010. It is for update one? I think that's what they were calling it. So you can get USMT version 4.0. Thanks, Johan. USMT version 4.0 by itself won't take you from 2007 to 2010. The reason why is because the USMT team didn't have the pieces ready yet when 2010 shipped. So you have to get the update for USMT 4.0, and then it will take you from 2007 to 2010. So the original USMT 4.0 will take you from 2003 to 2007, but the update will get you to 2010. Your operating system settings that are not migrated, yes? Will it go from 2003 to 2010? I honestly don't know. Johan, do you or Mike know? Yeah, I definitely haven't tested it, but sounds like it does. Mike shaking his head yes, too. Okay. Okay, so you can try that, and then I'll give you my card. You can email me and tell me how it goes. I'd appreciate that, and I'll build it into my next talk. So this is just a list of your operating system settings that will not be migrated. So you do get information like if you had drives that were mapped, you'll get that, but you don't actually get the data behind those drive mappings. You just get the fact that you had drive mappings. Hardware-related settings. Somebody asked me, can you migrate your printers? Still not. But you know, printers aren't that big of a deal anymore. With Windows 7, if you can get your printers into the driver store, any user, you don't have to be an administrator to actually flip the switch and install the driver, as long as it's in the driver store. So make sure that all of your drivers for your printers are in the driver store of your default image you're going to blast out. And then based on what they hook up to, they can go ahead and install the driver themselves. You don't need to be an admin to do that portion of it. Migrating from XP. The rule of thumb they went with here is if it makes the settings less secure, it doesn't get migrated. And what I mean by that specifically is internet connection firewall checks, the checkbox on whether it's enabled or disabled, those settings are not migrated because the firewall should be turned on, in their opinion. Internet connection sharing setting is not migrated because that could make the machine less secure. The firewall advanced configuration settings are not migrated due to security risks. Awesome, thank you. So he just checking in on the migrating from Office 2003 to 2010. He said it's supported. The network connections where it lists your NICs for you, your adapters, sometimes that doesn't get populated properly. All you have to do is F5 and it should show up. Everything should show up again. Data and USB connected drives that will get stored in your user state unless you use the local only option. And this is what it looks like to use scan state local only. So if you use local only, any devices that are connected through USB, you will not get the data in the user state. If you want the data, don't put the local only option and you'll get the data. Here's some examples of running scan state. Scan state and give it a path where you want to store the data. Here I'm telling it to put it in the C:\USMT folder. Just run it with the automatic settings. And here we're doing hard link and no compression of the data. The data can be stored in one of three ways. These are your migration stores, either uncompressed, compressed, or in a hard link format, which is really more of a table of where the data resides. The default setting is compressed because where we came from with USMT is that we're going to scan the local machine and then store it on a server somewhere. So, of course, we wanted it to be compressed so we didn't take up much hard drive space or as much as it would be uncompressed. But you can choose to use uncompressed if you'd like. Running load state, there are a few examples of your load state commands, pretty similar to the scan state commands. And it looks like I'm going to finish a little bit early on this. Does anybody have any questions on things that I've covered? Yes.
Is there a way to convert our version 1 running profile to a version 2 on the server side?
That's a great question. Is there any way to convert a version 1 roaming profile to a version 2 roaming profile? I don't know of any tools that will do that. And I haven't started talking to the server side of the house yet. So I've been working with the client. At Microsoft, I've been working with the client guys on user profiles trying to get this much figured out. That was the next step, is I wanted to figure out if you already have all of your roaming profiles stored on a server, how can you just in one fell swoop turn them into version 2? And I haven't yet figured that out. If you want to take my card and shoot me that as a question, when I do find the answer, I'll put you on the list of people I'm going to email it out to. Well, not if you've done anything crazy like ntuser.man. So if you've done like mandatory profiles, roaming profiles, it doesn't automatically convert to Windows 7. Yes. It's still mandatory. So what he's asking is, when I do a mandatory profile in Windows 7, and I've named it mandatory.v2, when you actually look at the profile that gets created locally on that machine, the ntuser.dat is ntuser.dat. It doesn't change it to man. I honestly don't know why they didn't change it to something different so you could tell anything. but
checking that advanced settings did actually save the metal profile.
Right. It just doesn't change it locally, so when you go look at that profile, it's a bit confusing. Well, guys, we covered, wow, I'm starting to get really squeaky now. Sorry about that. We covered local, roaming, mandatory, and super mandatory profiles now, so all of you can say you know what super mandatory profiles are. Talked a little bit about folder redirection, offline files, and your new group policy settings to control both of those things. We looked at customizing the default user profile, the Microsoft-supported way, and then I gave you kind of my little crib notes for how I actually do it every once in a while. And then we finished up with user state migration tool, migrating those XP profiles to Windows 7. The coolest thing you can do is just use MDT because it does all of this for you under the hood. You don't have to go do scan state, load state. You can just put a check mark in a box and you're pretty much done. I've got two more talks. I'll have my voice back completely by 5 o'clock tomorrow. Tomorrow is one of my fun talks. Windows deployment services. Anybody running WDS, the new version, latest version of RIS? If you're not running it, this would be a great talk if you want to run it, because I'm going to hit the top 10 issues people run into and how to resolve them. And I'm going to start out with installation and infrastructure. So really hit the nitty-gritty, things that I see being implemented incorrectly in environments all the time. So that's the top 10 WDS issues. And then Friday, 8:15 is my favorite talk, MDT in the real world. What I really do when I walk into a client's environment. I like to share that with you guys so that you don't go make the same mistakes that I've seen so many other people make. I want your experience with MDT and WDS to be a happy one, not a frustrating one. This is all my contact information, my Twitter handle, email address, website. I'd love to hear from you guys as you get started using these tools. If you have questions on profiles, since I am working with Microsoft right now to try to figure out how everything works in profiles, feel free to email me your questions. If I can't answer them, I can always hook you up with somebody there who can answer them. Guys, I want to thank you very much for attending my session. Really appreciate that. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference. Have a good night. Thanks.